From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We are going to be talking cost of college this hour, and I know there's a lot of listener interest. We're going to get to that discussion in just a moment, but we're going to get to, right off the top, an update on our breaking news that we've been following, the death of Assemblyman Bill Nojay. Randy Gorman, news director for WXXI, is here. Randy.
Thanks, Evan. A big shocker, obviously, for folks in the political world and in the community at large, and those of us in the media who covered Mr. Nojay for a number of years. He is dead, apparently, of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Rochester police, while not confirming the name, other sources have, tell us they got a what's known as a check the welfare call. Someone apparently called it concerned about Mr. Nojay. Later went to the Riverside Cemetery in Rochester. The officer apparently saw the person shoot himself and kill himself. And again, they are not confirming the name, but various sources tell us that incident is the one related to the death of Bill Nojay. As you know, a longtime active person in Republican politics, he was first elected to the state assembly in 2012. I believe he ran unopposed last time around. He was actually facing a primary next Tuesday. We had spoke to him very recently, seemed to be, you know, pretty upbeat mood. Most folks that did said he was typical Bill, kind of brash, but, you know, seemed to be in pretty good spirits lately. I did speak a short while ago to his assembly minority leader, Republican Brian Cole, who is from Canandaigua, has also known him for about 20 years. Let me ask you, first of all, I guess stunned is just one of the words I was using. Tell me about Bill, first of all, your reaction today. You certainly knew him for quite a long time.
I have. Bill and I go back almost 20 years, and Bill actually helped me in my very first election in the courtroom when we were battling the New York City Assembly Democrat attorneys regarding the close election that we had. And obviously, we became close and friends, and obviously, ultimately, then serving in the legislature after that. It's just, I'm just almost speechless because it's just something you never expect. And you know, Bill's a friend and a colleague, but it's just, not only do I feel bad, but I'm sure what's even more tragic is what his family is dealing with right now in this sudden news.
Yeah, and certainly, and I know, you know, we're trying to go easy on some of the speculation, but there has been a lot of it, including, you know, people, various sources saying that they believe it was a self-inflicted kind of situation. Bill, we were saying earlier on the air today that basically he always seemed, at least to me, a pretty upbeat guy. Did you always get that impression in terms of his general demeanor?
Oh, absolutely. Bill was, you know, I can't tell you the number of conversations we've had. Whether it's local politics, state politics, international or world politics, I always upbeat, always positive. You know, he would let it out when he was not happy with people or happy with policies, but he never did it in a mean sort of way. It was just that he just was speaking his mind, and I always respected that of Bill.
Yeah, certainly, you know, he spoke his mind and to the media as well with his, you know, his press releases and his statements. And I know he was not happy with the way things were going in terms of the legislature and with state government in general. Evan Dawson was saying on Connections earlier today that he did find, despite, you know, his pretty firm opinions about the way things should be, that Nojay seemed to be willing to listen to the other side of the aisle. Did you get that impression?
Oh, absolutely. Although sometimes he would listen to him with a tongue in cheek. but no, he was open-minded, but he was also had his very strong opinions about, you know, the negative impact on liberal policies in the state legislature and with the governor that was having a detrimental effect on our economy and our, you know, the cost of living in New York State and the fact that we're taking away our Second Amendment rights with the SAFE Act. Bill was passionate about all those issues, and he let them all know about it, whether it was through his radio show or on the floor of the assembly.
Yeah, he was involved. We were discussing this earlier in a lot of things people may not have known. I know he did some election monitoring and consulting work around the world. So he was a guy who kind of transcended a bit above just his local political situation, right?
Well, for sure. You know, you could have a conversation with just about anything in terms of international politics, and I know he traveled overseas and tried to make sure the elections were fair or try to be fair elections in other countries to bring democracy. I mean, you know, that's great work. And, you know, it's just, you know, not everybody does that. And I think he walked the talk in terms of the world of government and politics. And his voice, strong voices, in my opinion, is going to be sorely missed.
Assemblyman Brian Kolb, the Assembly Minority Leader, a lot of politicians weighing in with statements today. Of course, his opponent in the primary, Republican primary next week, the Honeyland Falls Mayor Richard Milne, says he is just devastated, expects to have a full statement later, but really just stunned by what happened. Democrats reacting as well. The Assembly Speaker, Carl Hastie, saying he says he can't express how saddened they are to learn about the passing of Mr. Nojay, says his thoughts and prayers are with his wife and children. Jamie Romeo, the Monroe County Democratic Chairwoman, and also Barbara Bear, who would be the Democratic candidate facing Nojay in November, released a statement saying they are also deeply saddened by the news and say while they disagreed on most policy issues, they called Nojay a kind and smart man who was a pleasure to see on the campaign trail, saying their thoughts are with the family. Similar statement from Cheryl DeNolfo, fellow Republican, county executive, expressing her feelings. We talked the last hour, Evan, of course, comments from Bill Reilich and really from just a whole host of, as you might expect, Western New York politicians. So, for again, for folks who had not heard, 59-year-old Bill Nojay, long active Republican politics, dead apparently of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. We don't have a lot of details beyond that right now, but of course we will update you throughout the afternoon and during All Things Considered.
Thank you, Randy Gorman. More at WXXINews.org as we get it. And let's turn now to the discussion that we had scheduled for this hour. Our connection this hour was going to be made, I think, well, right here in our studio, I guess about a month ago. We had Nazareth College President Don Braveman here as part of a panel, and he made a statement that caused a lot of listeners to write to me and say, hold on, you've got to check this. We were discussing Hillary Clinton's college affordability plan, and President Braveman said that the cost of college has not risen as precipitously as is often described. And then we moved on to some other points. But that single comment generated more listener email than just about anything else in recent months. I can't tell you how many people asked me to follow up on this, flesh it out. So if you missed it, here's what Don Braveman said that day.
If you just look at what the net cost is, it's actually gone up 30% in 26 years, which comes out to 1.17% a year. So there's somewhat of a misperception about an exploding cost of higher education.
That's Don Braveman, and he's generous enough to come back on the program today to discuss it further. I've done my best to sift through available data and reporting, so this hour let's try to answer several questions. How much has the cost of college really gone up in recent years? When we say cost, what do we mean by that? How much is college subsidized? What about other things like needs-blind admission? And if colleges have large endowments, why are they doing what some say is not a very good job of bringing more impoverished students to campus? My guests for the hour include Don Braveman, president of Nazareth College. Great to have you back here, Don.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And Ian Mortimer's here, Nazareth's vice president for enrollment management. Ian, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so, and grab that microphone, get it nice and close there, Ian. You guys are almost on the, we joked, almost on the payroll here. They've been here so often, but our listeners have been very, very keen to talk about this. And the first thing I'm going to say right away is, going through the numbers, Don, you were right. The college, the actual cost, not the sticker right. price. List price or sticker price is what most people refer to when they talk about college tuition, and list price is way up. We know that it is way up, but when we talk about the actual price, which is the price that students and their families are actually paying in practice, it is just over 1% a year up for private schools, up a little bit higher for public schools, 2 to 4% I'm seeing in various areas, but it's not the explosion right. sticker price. So first of all, why right. is the difference? What's the difference in sticker price?
Well, first let me say for the doubters.
Are you going to gloat here?
No, I'm not. But I will refer them to College Board published and net prices. Go to their Google, type in that, and look at Table 7. And that will give you the sticker price and net costs for college, private and public, since 1990. Up to the present. So the difference between the two, the sticker price is obviously the tuition and fees that are advertised. It's X thousands of dollars. The net price is what families actually pay after taking into consideration institutional aid, scholarships, or federal grants.
Not like, loans,
like,
though.
No, we're not talking about loans. We're talking about
loans
grants.
Loans do not get included in this.
No.
So we're grants only. Yeah.
Right. So you have what are known as Pell Grants. Mm-hmm. You have SEOG grants. So there are federal grants that are available for people, Bundy Aid grants. There are all kinds of grants that are available. But these are not loans. So if you add up what the average student is getting for institutional aid and these other grants, that becomes the net price. And the net price since 1990 has gone up a little bit over 1%. And just by comparison, I'll just throw this out and let the audience think about this. I took a look at what it cost to operate a car since 1990. And in 1990, the cost of operating a car for that's driven 15,000 miles a year was 33 cents a mile. In 2014, it was 58 cents a mile. It went up 75% in that period of time. And tuition, net tuition at colleges went up 30%. So the public is really focused on colleges, but there are a lot of other things that went up significantly in price.
All right, now that we've let you have your moment there, now the grilling can start here.
So all right, let's
do this in a couple of ways. I already see the phone ringing here. First of all, on the sticker price side, why has the sticker price gone up? And let me be specific. At Nazareth, what's the full tuition room board sticker is what? 40-something? What is it?
For the tuition and fees, it's $31,000 and change. And then room and board, depending on which dorm you live in and what food package you get, is about another $10,000.
Okay, so just over $41,000 at Nazareth, which is above the national average, but significantly below. We see
No, it's not above the average for private colleges.
For private 4 years?
Yes.
It's not?
It's not. We are actually in 2016, the average sticker price, now not for room and board because that goes all over the place, but tuition and fees was $32,000.
Right around 32, okay.
And we were below that. And,
okay, forgive me because I had all these other numbers, but the 32 number I thought included room and board. It does not.
No.
Okay, so Nazareth just below the national average on the four-year privates at 41. We see U of R, HWS, a number of others around 60 or higher, and that's the sticker price. And Don, why is that sticker price so much higher than where it was 20 years ago? Not the actual price, not the, you know, the net price, but why is the sticker price so high? I'll ask both of you if you want to weigh in on that.
Well, that's a good question. One of the reasons sticker price has gone up, quite frankly, is because the market thinks if it costs more, it's better. So one of the things that's happened over the last 30 years, 26 years, is that colleges raise their sticker price to appeal to that market. But what happened is, and the reason there's a difference, and this is, and I said last time, and I really believe this, it's really a problem I think that higher education needs to address. What happened is the public is now conditioned to getting a scholarship. And families would rather be told that, you know, the sticker price is $40,000, but their child is getting a $15,000 scholarship, than to just be told the cost is $25,000, you're not getting anything. So it became a marketing technique, I think, for colleges, quite frankly. I don't know.
Ian, you agree?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think, though, that has slowed down in the last couple of years, given, you know, the reaction in the media in terms of sticker price. I mean, from, you know, 01 to, you know, up until the recession, it was pretty rampant that you would see pretty significant increases. But it has slowed down in the past 4 or 5 years.
Now I want to try to understand who's paying what. And I will say, right off the bat here, there's a lot of local institutions that don't like to come on and talk about this. And I'm really glad that you guys are here and are willing to do that. I referenced in the tease to this program the fact that author Malcolm Gladwell has been sort of putting podcasts together, and he's really targeted higher education in a number of ways. But one of the things he did was he went out to Vassar and he talked to how they are doing it. So here are the numbers from Vassar that Malcolm Gladwell reported this past summer. 2,450 undergrads at Vassar. You guys are around 2,000?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So a little bit larger, but not that much different. At Vassar, 1,000 of the 2,450 pay full tuition or close to it, which is 60,000. So, you know, about 1,000. How many of Nazareth's 2,000 are paying full tuition or close to it?
Almost zero.
Almost zero? Almost zero?
Yes. When you look at the institutional grant and the other grants that are available to them, they're all getting some kind of grant aid. Not borrowing. Again, we're not talking about loans. We're talking about some kind of grant.
So if tuition, room and board comes to $41,000 or so at NAS, nobody is paying $41,000 on that campus?
Maybe a handful.
How many are paying $38,000?
Very few.
Wow. Okay.
And can I add a comment?
Sure.
I mean, part of it is where we're located. So 120 miles from our campus, there are 34 baccalaureate degree-granting institutions. And so competition actually drives down net price for individuals that live in Western and Central New York.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah.
At Vassar, of the 1,450 students who are paying nowhere close to the full ride, I think their VPs and the people who sat down with Malcolm Gladwell said essentially their endowment helps support those students in many ways. So yes, there are grants and there's aid, but the fact that they have an endowment helps them make this decision on how many students are going to pay full ride, how many are going to get help, what can they afford to do. How much is endowment a factor at Nazareth? I have no idea what an endowment looks like there.
Our endowment is a small factor in terms of aid.
Okay.
We generate about $3 million a year. Some of that is restricted to aid. Some is used for other things as well. So in terms of our income, so it's a relatively small part of our budget. I think one of the things that is driving, you know, our aid costs is we have a very large percentage of Pell Grant students. So we have about 30% of our students.
And the Vassar is 24%.
Actually, it's a little more than 30%. It's almost a third.
And that's very high from what I've seen. From the research I've seen in terms of private schools, 30% or more is very high.
And we're proud of it, by the way.
Absolutely.
I mean, we're one of the things that we are committed to is creating access for people who can't otherwise afford college education. So that's something we're very proud of, but it does drive up the need for financial aid.
Okay. At Vassar, 20 years ago, 80% of students paid the full ride or close to it. Now it's 40%. It's been cut in half. 20 years ago at Nazareth, how many were paying full ride? If you're guessing there. I don't know if you had that.
No idea.
I would think at least some.
Be higher than now, probably.
Higher than zero. Anything is higher than zero. So that's what has changed in many ways in 20 years. Now I want to look at low-income students because in various places, including, and let me grab what I got from The Atlantic, they've been reporting on who is actually going to college. Here we go. Based on U.S. Census Bureau figures, the percentage of students from low-income families attending college immediately after getting their high school diplomas has declined by 10 percentage points since 2008, from 56% to 46%. To be fair, some of that comes in the for-profit college world, which is a whole other animal, and those numbers attending that, thank goodness, are going down. But most of the drop in low-income students going to college right out of high school is in two-year schools and in public schools. In the four-year private, it's roughly flat. But what we're looking at nationwide is from 2008 to 2013, we've gone from 69% to 66% of high school graduates, all high school graduates, going right to college. So that number has gone down slightly. It's gone down stronger in the lower income group. What's going on at NAS? Are you seeing more lower income, less? Is it flat? What's the situation there?
Just to share some data, about 20% of last year's class, we're still finalizing the data for this year, but 20% of last year's class had an aggregate income of less than $40,000 a year, and 40% had an income less than $75,000 per year. And that's been pretty consistent for, you know, 15, 14, and 13. So, you know, we serve a lot of families that need help and need support. And that's the only data that I'm aware of.
You serve more than most.
Yes.
And I'm not doing this for PR for Nazareth.
Yeah.
And I taught one college class in my life. It was at Nazareth. I'm not there anymore. This is not a Homer job.
Yeah.
Here's the Jack Kent Cook Foundation. A recent study by the Jack Kent Cook Foundation found that only 3% of students at what you would call top colleges come from the poorest 25% of families, while a staggering 72% of students at so-called top colleges come from the richest 25%. Translation is that the working class is history at Ivy League schools and their ilk, and the middle class is even being squeezed out. Harold Levy is the executive director of the Jack Kent Cook Foundation. And he says many people hold the mistaken view that outstanding high school students from low-income families will have no trouble being admitted to the colleges of their dreams and paying for tuition and living costs thanks to, quote, need-blind admissions policies. But in fact, only about 100 of the nation's approximately 4,200 colleges and universities offer need-blind admissions, meaning that a student's ability to pay is not considered by the schools when choosing which students to accept. And admission to these schools is not always accompanied by sufficient financial aid to cover a lower-income student's costs. Needs blind.
Can I just say that what you're reading, the national demographics and information here doesn't describe Nazareth. I can just say that, and it's by intent. We have intentionally reached out to try to make access available for people who historically wouldn't go to four-year private school.
Because this isn't wrong, is it? When I'm reading from...
Maybe I'm sure the national numbers, level. Right. I'm just saying at our school, and I want to say a word about this, the private schools in New York as well.
Okay.
But at Nazareth, over the last 8 years, we have really made we've made a concerted effort to really expand access. One of the things we had started a couple years ago is to try to create access for students from high-performing high schools throughout New York State. So we now have a partner, and actually it extends beyond New York. We have a partnership with three schools in Brooklyn. We have a partner in New York City and actually Brooklyn Bronx as well. We have a partnership with a school in Philadelphia. These are high-performing urban schools. Students are very poor, but the kids are terrific students. And we have started partner, and we've brought in a number of students from there. High need, financial need, but high in terms of their scholastic ability. And what we're trying to do, besides create access, is change some of the discussion about urban education. Because all you hear about in with respect to urban education is how awful the schools are. Well, we've found some really high-performing urban schools that are producing great students. So our story is, I think, a little different here in terms of trying to create access. And my message is, and I guess what I'd conclude from all this is, if schools are intentional about creating access, they can do it. A word about New York State. The private schools in New York educate as many students from poor families as the four-year SUNY schools. Now, that's an interesting thing to reflect on. So private schools, there are about 110 or 20 of us, I forgot the exact number. We educate as many students from low-income families as the SUNY private four-year schools. So what's going on here? The private schools throughout New York are making a lot of aid available to low-income families is what's going on.
Okay, and so if we've established a number of facts here, one of the facts being that the cost of college, the actual cost, not the sticker price, but the net cost, has only gone up just over 1% in four-year private colleges over the last couple of decades. It's not exploded at the rate people think. The sticker price makes people think so. Very few people pay the full sticker price, especially at schools like Nazareth, but even a minority of students paying the full sticker at most four-year privates these days. If that's the case, then here's another number you often hear. Why do we have $1.3 trillion in student loan debt? And there are a number of questions, I think, that come out of that for me. One of them being this. Is the lower middle and the lower class of this country simply growing? Is that why we see the number stagnating? We keep saying, well, there's more aid going out. There's more federal aid. The federal government is offering, at least under President Obama from 2008 to 2015, the numbers indicate more aid, more emphasis on federal aid, more available, whether it's Pell or otherwise. But that's hard if you're trying to keep up with a growing lower or lower to middle class. Is that what's happening?
Well, I can share with you what I see in our applicant pool, in our acceptance pool. And one of the dynamics is that I do see quite a bit. A lot of families are still recovering from the recession. And so, you know, savings accounts, you know, probably aren't what they were, you know, before 2008. And, you know, when we talk with families, there is a lot of heartache, you know, in terms of, you know, lost jobs and job transition and, you know, incomes, you know, going up and down and, you know, all kinds of situations that at least feel like it's kind of the new normal now. And in that context, you know, one of the few ways that I think families look like they can access, you know, the education that they're seeking is to take on, you know, some debt. So I do think 08 has had an impact on terms of that. And then, you know, the other thing is, you know, I think there are families, to be very candid with you, that probably do overstretch. You know, there are, again, going back to where we are, there are a lot of good options. You know, we have one of the best community colleges in the nation in our backyard that delivers a high quality cost at a very, you know, value oriented rate. We have two SUNY schools within 30 miles of Rochester, a lot of privates that are competing for the best and the brightest. So, again, getting back to the idea that sometimes families may make decisions in terms of over-leveraging, it absolutely happens.
Okay. And then let me turn to some of our listeners who want to ask about why we are where we are, or at least kind of wade through some of the numbers. I'm going to start with Paul in Irondequoit, then we'll come to John in Fairport. Go ahead, Paul.
You know, I'd like to recognize the good work that these people are doing, because if they didn't care about the situation, they would have never even bothered with it. Now, here's my opinion of this. The average working family, you know, has not had any increases in wages really over the years, and actually a decrease in like pensions and health care benefits and everything else. And it's all catching up. And it's very nice that Nazareth is putting money up to help these people out. But I was in another state recently. Their state employees received a 6% raise. The average wage in the county I was in was $24,000. None of them people can afford to go to college in the northern part of the state because it's just too expensive. So, you know, to me, it what you're saying is the breaking up of the middle class is really what's hurting the funding. It's not the colleges themselves.
I think that's exactly right, Paul. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really sharp analysis of it, and I'm trying to be an evidence-based guy here with this. I'm saying, all right, Don Braidman shocked us all last month when he said the cost of college isn't going up as much as we think. Sticker price, yes. Actual cost, no. Numbers from the College Board investigation by the New York Times bears all of that out. It's true. It's a fact. We can grapple with it. So why do we have more debt? Well, as Ian said, you had the crash. Maybe some families are overextending. Maybe students are going in with less savings, or families going in with less savings. And when you have income inequality and you've got wages that kind of do that we've seen, more at the top and a lot more at the bottom and a lot not nearly as much in the middle, then you have loan debt like this. I think that's probably right. A good analysis.
I think there are two other factors that play into this $1.3 trillion number, and I would love to see someone tease it out. One is we do have more people going to college today than we did 5 years ago. So there are more people borrowing. So the fact that there's more debt may be a function in part because there are more people going to college. The other thing that's really hard to tease out is the impact of these for-profit colleges, where a lot more people are going to these for-profit colleges. They're not graduating. Their graduation rate at these schools is abysmal, and they're borrowing very heavily. In fact, the way the for-profit colleges work is they work by getting their students to borrow and getting federal money. They take the money, and then the kids don't graduate. So I think in order to really understand this $1.3 trillion number, we need to tease it out. We need to get rid of the for-profits from that number. We need to see the increase in enrollment.
Don, I am sure with one candidate behind Trump University and the other candidate whose husband made $17 million from the for-profit industry, I'm sure real regulation is coming.
Well, I'm not getting involved in politics
on this show. No matter who is elected, I'm sure of it.
It's another show.
John in Fairport. Let me get back to your phone calls. John in Fairport, go ahead.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call. I called in actually on the original show, I think it was August 10th, and asked a question about this. And I guess because I've been following the topic, I've poked at some other data out there. And I'm wondering, I've got two lines of inquiry, really. One is the data itself and how you choose the data to support your argument. And then I think the second is really sort of a market-based question. You know, are parents and students demanding degrees that really will lead to a career that will enable them to pay back their student loans? So on the first point, as I'm sitting here, I'm looking at a graph published by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, choosing 1994, the base year, which is only 22 years ago, showing the cost of public tuition and fees for four-year public universities going up 110%. So I'm just wondering if there's something that happens if you go back 30 years.
John, it's 90 to 110% that on the sticker price.
And you're also looking at public schools as opposed to private. If you look at the public schools, what's very interesting about what's happened over the last 22, three decades is the cost of public schools, the sticker price, the price they say they're for tuition fees, has gone up much higher rate, and their net has even gone up a much higher rate than the privates. So when you look at the data, I've been talking about the data for private four-year schools. The data for the four-year public schools, I've got that right here. Since 1990, the sticker price has gone up 6.5% per year, and the net tuition has gone up 4.25%. So actually, the public schools across the country have gone up at a higher rate, both the sticker price and the net price, than the private. So you have to distinguish between the two.
John, go ahead.
All right, so anyway, and again, the same graph shows private's going up at 60% over the same 22-year time frame. But the other side of my question really relates to the fact that I think I look at it as one of the popular degrees is a business degree, for example, whereas there was actually an OECD study that was published a few years ago that talks about manufacturing and certain low-skill tasks being automated, and then the demand for information processing and other high-level cognitive and interpersonal skills is growing. That's a direct quote. And so they're really talking about the fact that we're not getting students coming out of college with the right skill sets. And I just wonder if, on a broader basis, what we're looking at here is an increased number of college graduates with the wrong kinds of degrees, the wrong kind of skills, going out into a marketplace where they end up working in call centers or at Starbucks and not being able to pay their student loans.
It's a very good question, John. Ian Mortimer, you want to start?
Yeah, I think what I'm seeing is it's less alignment in terms of what they study. And I think the focus needs to be more on what they do in addition to their studies. So when we talk to employers, the thing that we hear over and over again is they need students who can solve problems, work in teams, and have the soft skills and the behaviors that allow them to function within those organizations productively, efficiently, and effectively. With that being said, when you graduate, you have to have some relevancy to the employment market. And so you have to solve some employer's problem when it comes to their needs. And what we're finding is that, you know, students can, you know, essentially major in anything, but if they have the right internships and the right experiences that prove out that they have at least some set of the skills that employers are seeking immediately, plus the balance of a liberal arts education, that is the secret sauce. And so we're putting a lot of effort into that mode where, you know, obviously what you study is important, has to have some relevancy, but really, really pushing students into experiences very early so that they, when they graduate, they have a resume, they have the skill set, and they have the network. And those three things are really, really uber important in today's environment.
President Braverman?
You know, one of the things we have just initiated this year, and I've been here now 12 years at this school, and it's one of the most exciting new initiatives that we've undertaken. We call it the Center for Life's Work. And you know, every college in the country has Career Services Office, and in the junior and senior year, they start working with the students on trying to find jobs. What we're doing now is we're starting with freshmen, and we're getting them to start thinking about not what they want to do in their first job, but what is it they want to do with their life's work, and then figuring out what do they need to do while they're in college, not only from an academic side, but as Ian pointed out, in terms of internships, in terms of experiential learning, in terms of summer jobs, in order to maximize that possibility so that college becomes a bridge to a full, meaningful career. And it's really an exciting project. We've just hired an executive director. We're hiring career coaches to work with the students. But I think the caller raises a very significant point here, and that has to do with, we've talked about the cost side of higher ed, but what's the value side? Because it's always a value proposition. People look at the price and the value and make a decision. And every study I have seen has indicated that even with higher costs, that the value of a degree is better when you factor that in, is higher. The value of the degree is higher than if you don't have it. So the unemployment rate for people with high school degrees only is much higher than the unemployment rate for someone with a bachelor's degree. The lifelong earning capacity is much higher, even taking into the cost of education. The other thing that's happening, and I think the caller alluded to this, is the nature of jobs is changing. So we're moving from a manufacturing economy to a higher technology type of economy, and employers are demanding bachelor's degrees at minimum. In fact, many are moving on and saying we need a master's degree as well. So The value of an education, of a college education, I think, is only going up over time.
Well, let's let John respond one more time if you want to follow up. Go ahead, John.
Well, I don't want to debate it, actually. First of all, I want to applaud the efforts that were just described. And secondly, I think I'm familiar with Nazareth moving a lot of their resources toward programs that give people qualifications in healthcare. So there's an example of a growing market being served by a local university, and so I applaud that effort. My final point, I guess, and then I'll give somebody else a chance here, is that I think it's important that we not blame institutions of government for their failures, or even the universities to some degree. It's really up to parents and students to take responsibility for their own outcomes. And before they go off to college, somebody should be discovering what employers want and figure out how to get the training and education they really need.
Paul is exactly right in terms of what we see parents doing now. Parents are much more focused than perhaps 10 years ago on outcomes. Will my child be able to get a job in the field that he or she is interested in, or go to graduate school? We have a large percentage of our students who go to graduate school, probably 35%. Or more go to graduate school. They don't go right into the market. But yes, parents are looking at that, and colleges need to respond.
All right, let's get our only break of the hour. And when we come back here, we're going to hit, we haven't covered all the ground yet here. A couple of points that we're going to work through, including what Gladwell has said is a moral problem at some private schools, the amenities race that he thinks is out of control, that he thinks is impacting how many lower income students are able to go to college, and you know, everything from climbing walls to lazy rivers for $100 million and high-end dining and everything else. What's the state of the amenities race? How is that impacting cost? Is that part of the blame? We'll hit that and more when we come back with a couple of the administrators, including the president of Nazareth College, next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, Pittsford graduate and former State Department official Todd Moss joins us. He's not working for the State Department on African Affairs anymore. He's writing thrillers about international diplomacy. His third book is called Ghosts of Havana, set between the United States and Cuba. We'll talk to him about the book and how he sees international affairs in the context of the election Monday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I mentioned that author Malcolm Gladwell has been going after higher education in his podcast series, Revisionist History. And he's been going after amenities, things like sparkling high-end dorms, the climbing walls, which is like this you know, sort of this international metaphor now for profligate spending, I guess. But especially food. Gladwell compared Bowdoin and Vassar. Bowdoin has, in Gladwell's words, a world-class chef and nearly a Michelin star. Vassar has soggy pizza. But because Bowdoin spends so much on dining, he says it offers significantly less in Pell grants. About 24% of Vassar students are on Pell, 12% at Bowdoin. And let's, in a second, John, if we could, let's listen to what Malcolm Gladwell concludes about the amenities race and Bowdoin versus Vassar.
There's only one solution. If you're looking at liberal arts colleges, don't go to Bowdoin. Don't let your kids go to Bowdoin. Don't let your friends go to Bowdoin. Don't give money to Bowdoin or to any other school that serves amazing food in its dining hall. Because every time you support a school that spends its money on amazing food, Every time you cast a vote in favor of eggplant parmesan pancakes and lobster bakes and venison during deer season, you're making it harder and harder for someone like Catherine Hill to create opportunities for poor kids.
All right. I know you haven't listened to the whole episode there, Don, but he's saying you can't go to Bowdoin because...
Well, go to Nazareth. That's what I say.
Because they have... Listen, what Gladwell's saying is they have... Schools like Bowdoin have prioritized catering to the families that want a Michelin star dining hall, super high-end dorms that look like nice hotels, and that when you do that, he thinks the evidence shows fewer low-income kids get help. Is that too broad a conclusion, or is there something to it?
Quite honestly, I don't know what... It's so not our experience. I mean, the only climbing wall at Nazareth is in my office, and I'm the only one who climbs up it. But the you know, to be serious for a moment, about 10 years ago, we made a decision that if we're going to invest in new facilities, they are going to be academic. So since I've been at Nazareth, we remodeled our art center, which is the home for our really growing visual and performing arts programs. We built a science building that Princeton Review just last week named as one of the 20 best laboratory facilities in the United States. And we last year completed our building that houses our health and human services programs that the caller was referring to. So we have invested in academic programs. We have no climbing walls. In fact, if there's anything we're lacking, we probably need a better student union. We don't really have a great gathering space for you know, that kind of experience.
Do you feel pressure, though, from parents when they visit the school and they go, you don't?
I haven't felt
I mean,
need
I
to build
a like,
climbing
on.
Wall. I have not. I
no,
tell
no,
you,
no,
the only
forget the climbing wall, food, dining.
Well, I, the on. Only I have to say the one I
residence
did,
halls.
I have not. The only complaint I once got, and it's curious that this parent felt free to call the president's office about this, but I had a parent once call and say that her daughter didn't like the sauce on the fish the night before in the dining hall. It's a good thing I didn't take the call because my response would have been, well, tell her not to eat the fish. But no, we don't get a lot of pressure. We do get the students are concerned sometimes about food. They want, but they're not looking for, you know, fancy food. What they want is mostly choice. They want really, the biggest issue is when can we get access to the food? Because students don't want to have to eat between 5 and 7.
But what about sparkling athletic and workout facilities, things like that? When I was at Ohio right. University several decades ago, I remember when the Ping Center opened, and that was a huge deal on campus. Now, as a student, I loved it, but I have no idea what it cost, tens of millions of dollars.
We have not invested in that. That's all I can say is we have not invested in...
If you did, would you be able to offer less financial help for lower-income students?
Well, if we... Obviously, if we build fancy centers that we're going to have to pay the carrying costs for those, it's going to have to come out of something. But it's just, you know, it's so outside of my realm. It's hard for me. You know, I'm sure schools do it. You hear about it all the time. There are some schools that have reputations of being country clubs. I don't know that they're doing it in response to parents. They may think that this is a good way to create demand. We've done it through academic programming. And what's interesting is our enrollment over the last 6 years since we've been building these buildings has been going up. We had the largest freshman class ever last year, and today we're one ahead of that. So as long as that person doesn't leave, we'll have the largest freshman class this year.
Okay. Ian, how do you feel about that, sort of that, is it a false choice of more amenities, better dining halls, better dorm rooms versus more help for lower-income students? That's how Gladwell presents it. Is that overly simplifying?
I think it is. I think every college and university makes a choice on what they differentiate on. In some, you know, in the South particularly, you know, places that have not had a lot of lineage have made the decision that, you know, we can't compete on academic quality and history and, you know, where our alums are. So we're going to build the most beautiful infrastructure that we possibly can. And that's going to attract a certain segment of the market. And that's how they've decided to spend their dollars. You know, from my perspective, you know, our students are very pragmatic. You know, as we said, 60% come from, you know, very modest incomes. And so they're not used to a lot of, you know, high-end amenities. And coming to Pittsford for a lot of them is like going to Palm Springs. You know, and just to kind of add one point to that. We talked a lot about, you know, kind of urban poverty, but I think one of the things that a lot of the area colleges have done well, and us as part of that, is that there's a lot of rural poverty as you get into the southern tier and, you know, the southern part of the Finger
Sure.
Lakes. And it's the same issues. And, you know, access to those students is also needs to be top of mind. But to answer your question, no, I just don't see it in our world.
Okay.
Can I just add that the other thing that, you know, a good question, I think, from the public is, well, why do costs go up at all? Why have there been rising costs? Now, you know, he suggests it's because people are building climbing walls. For us, the major drivers of the cost increases have been, one is technology. If you look over the last 30 years, 30 years ago, we didn't have the investment in technology that we have today. So we spend a lot of money on technology. We just spent $1.5 million to upgrade our wireless on campus. And students are coming with 6-7 devices. They're trying to get access at all at the same time, and it really puts a strain on the tech. So technology's been a really major driver of the increase in costs of colleges. And unlike certain manufacturing businesses where technology can actually make you more efficient and reduce your overall costs, in higher education and other similar industries that are based on people, it actually drives up the cost. And so technology has been a huge driver of our increase in costs.
Gladwell also talks about, I think it's the New York Times, they created an accessibility index largely based on Pell Grants. And he thinks there is a moral problem for schools that have huge endowments but have poor scores on accessibility index. And he points to Princeton, $22 billion with a B in their endowment. They make a lot of money just on the endowment return every year. And yet they still have people, an army of people going out talking to Princeton grads, trying to raise money. Here's Gladwell on Stephen Colbert's Late Show on CBS, just talking about his confusion over the massive endowments that some schools have.
Here's my favorite statistic.
Yeah? What is it?
If you sum up the endowments of the 7 Ivy League schools plus Stanford, you know how much money that comes to?
Mm-mm.
$140 billion. Do you know how many low-income children or students are educated by the Ivy Leagues plus Stanford?
What?
11,000. $140 billion over here, 11,000 over there. If you can tell me why that's a good thing, I'm all ears.
Don Braveman?
Well, we don't have that problem.
Is he right that that's
a
problem?
But I do think that there are some very wealthy schools who could be using their endowments differently. But I think the Gladwell observations highlight one of the difficulties we have in discussing higher education,
okay.
And that is that a lot of the discussion is based on activity at a relatively few number of schools.
Ivy League plus Stanford,
right.
For example.
They're the elite private schools or the major research universities. Most of the colleges in the United States are not them. Most of the colleges in the United States are smaller institutions. They don't have billion-dollar endowments, and they're not going crazy building all these climbing walls. So I think part of the issue is that when we read about higher education in the press and hear about it in the media, often we're focused on a very small percentage of the institutions that are really delivering education.
Okay. Ian, you want to weigh
in? I was just going to add, and I think, you know, we talked about the rise of sticker price. They, you know, historically have been the pace setters for a lot of that. So I think Don's absolutely right.
Okay, but on the sticker price issue, we've established that at NAS, almost nobody's paying full sticker price. But at schools like Vassar, it's 40% still paying close to. And Vassar's not an Ivy League, but it's a very good school. And so if I'm a student paying $60,000, if I'm paying the full ride at a school, whether it's Vassar or U of R or somewhere else, am I getting ripped off?
That's a decision that the student and the family, I think, have to make for themselves. I mean, that's an individual decision. I mean, and part of it to consider also is that there are over 250,000 international students that are clamoring to get into the top 20. And so a lot of that, in the top 40, you know, can include Vassar. And so a lot of, you know, the subsidies that, you know, may be going to distribute to other students are coming from the international students as well.
And it gets back to the price value proposition. So why would someone pay $60,000 a year at Vassar and instead of paying $30,000 somewhere else? They're obviously a price value that somebody has thought that their value is worth the extra money.
Yeah. Okay. Down to our last minute or so. Some final thoughts you want to leave the audience with, Don and Ian, when it comes to cost of college and what you want the public understanding to have going forward?
I guess I get back to the value proposition. A lot of the recent discussion is focused on the cost of higher ed, which we've already established hasn't gone up as much as everybody thinks it has. I think we really ought to be focusing on the value proposition. What is the value of the additional 4 years, or in some instances, a master's degree on top of a four-year degree? And one of the unfortunate aspects of the recent discussion is so much of the value proposition is focused on return on investment, which I understand, and people should focus on. Is it worth investing this amount to get that amount in return? But we need to also enter into the discussion the concern about, do we want an educated public? And that should be a factor. And that's a value proposition.
And in your words, that should be a yes, is what you're saying.
It's a big yes.
Well, I think what we all want is to make sure everyone has as much opportunity as possible. And the fact that we've seen a little bit of a stagnation with low-income students going to college, I think it's largely because the lower classes are growing. We have income inequality. That goes beyond higher ed institutions. That's about economic policy writ large. That's a societal problem that we're grappling with in this election and beyond. And I just want to thank our guests for coming in and at least occasionally even opening their books and sharing their story. Not everybody will do it, I will say that. Ian Mortimer, thank you very, very much for being here from Nazareth College.
Thank you very much.
And President Don Braveman. Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend, everybody. I will talk with you on Monday.